Rishus Rabbi Hezbollah, Rishus Rabbi Blau, Rishus Rabbi Reese. There is a very powerful passage that is found in the Sefer Mitzvos Gedolos by Rav Moshe Mikusi. He went on a preaching tour throughout Spain. He discovered a lot of interesting things. And he writes in the Smag, and it's the first source on the sheet. He writes, Kar darashti legalus Yerushalayim asher b'Sfarad ulishar galeos Edom. I have already preached to all the exiles of Jerusalem, the Jews who are in Spain and other Christian lands. Ki ata sheherich hagalus yoser midai. Now that the exile has lasted for a very long time, an excessively long time. Yesh li Yisrael lahavdil. It is for the Jewish people to separate from the nonsense of the world, and to seize God's seal, Shehu Emes, which is truth. Velo v'shelo l'shaker lo Yisrael, velo l'goyim, not to lie to Jews, not to lie to Gentiles, velo lahat osam v'shum inyan, not to deceive them in any way. Ulekadesh atzman af bimutar lahem, and to sanctify themselves even with those things that are technically permitted to them. Shenemar she'eris Yisrael la yasu avla v'la yidabru chazav v'la yimatze b'fihem l'shon tarmis. That the remainder of the Jewish people, those who are left after all the tribulations of exile, will never commit iniquity, they will not speak falsehoods, and it will never be found in their mouths a slippery or slick or deceitful language. When God comes to save us, to save them and to redeem them, Yomru Hagoyim, the nations will say, Badin Asa, God has done justly. Kihem Anshe Emes, Visoras Emes Befihem, because they are people of truth and a truthful Torah is in their mouths. Aval, if they behave with Gentiles dishonestly, Yomru, the Gentiles will say, Ru'uma asa HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Look what God has done. Shebachar l'chelko, he has chosen for his portion, ganovim v'ramoim, thieves and liars. He continues to state that one of the purposes of the exile, according to the Gemara Pesachim, is that the Gentiles of the world should see the beauty of Judaism and be attracted and convert. And he writes at the end, V'chol zman she'yehim misnahim yemahem ramaus, as long as they behave deceitfully, mi yedbak behem, who will attach themselves to the Jewish people? The Smag here makes an observation about ethics which goes beyond the strict letter of the law. But in order to address his concerns, one first has to know what the din is, what the law is, and then to know what is lifnim mishuas adin, what is the sense of ethics that is beyond the letter of the law. Someone once observed that if only the prohibition of lo tignovu, the prohibition of theft, were a footnote in the Mishnah Brura instead of being a pasuk in the Torah, it might be more widely observed. What underlies this witty observation is a more ordinary reality that the laws of Choshen Mishpat, especially as they pertain to basic ethical behavior, are not sufficiently studied, nor known, nor understood by many so-called observant Jews. The choice of the Tor, and thus the Shulchan Aruch following him, to place these laws in Choshen Mishpat, a volume which for almost all intents and purposes has become the purview of specialists, as opposed to Orach Chaim, which it deals with the laws of daily life, which is much closer to the world of a typical balabayis, has perhaps exacerbated this situation. I'd imagine that the calculation that the Tor made was that basic ethical behavior is more or less intuitive. The primary role of Choshen Mishpat, not the only one, but the primary one, was to address after-the-fact liability and enforcement, not what is advisable and exemplary behavior. We can figure most of that out on our own. Beyond this, beyond whatever is found in Choshen Mishpat, most of the mitzvos that are classically regarded as mitzvos bein adam l'chaveiro, many of them, are not found in Shulchan Aruch at all. They were left for the Magen Avraham to collect in one very long sifkatan in Orach Chaim Siman Kuf Nun Vav. Laws such as V'ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha, loving one's neighbor as oneself, the prohibition of Nekama, taking revenge, the prohibition of Lashon Hara, which took the Chafetz Chaim pages and pages and pages to discuss the halachos, find no place in the Shulchan Aruch, as basic and as central as they are to Yahadus. Unfortunately, as recent events demonstrate all too well, there really is a need to discuss and to teach these issues in a more formal way, be it because these issues are not intuitive for everybody, or because some of us need to be reminded on a periodic basis that these are not just nice ideas, but behaviors which are mandated in many cases by din, and in some cases mandated by the Lifnei Mishuras HaDin. This evening, I wish to contribute to this enterprise by presenting an overview of one very significant topic of halacha found in Choshen Mishpat, which sits at the nexus of the halachic and ethical worlds, the issue referred to as Genevas Das. In source 2, on the sheets, there's the Tosefta found in Bava Kamma. The Tosefta lists 7 forms of theft. You probably didn't know that there were that many. They're classified by how the various kinds of punishments that are the result of theft. The Tosefta writes, Shiva ganavim hei. There are 7 kinds of ganavim. Harishon shebechulam, and some girsos have hagadol shebechulam, the greatest or the worst of them. I think the correct girso is the first. Gonev das habrios. Someone who deceives people. And now the Tosefta goes on to describe what is genevas das. If you invite somebody for a meal and you're not interested in the person coming, and you know he's not going to come, you know he's away, you know he's out for the meal already, and you're not interested, if you try to encourage him to accept a gift from you, and you know that he's not going to accept the gift. You open a fancy barrel of wine, not a bottle, but a barrel of wine, and once you open that wine is not going to last very long, at least not as being very good, and he assumes that you've opened the barrel in his honor, and that the rest of the barrel is going to mostly go to waste, or it's not really going to be used. So far, these are things that involve no financial deceit. Then the Tosefta continues, V'hama avel b'midos v'hama shakir b'mishkalos, someone who cheats in weights and measures. Note that the Torah describes this as Toavas Hashem, the abomination of God. V'hama arev es agira b'tilsan v'es achometz b'shemen, if someone adulterates commercial goods, you mix in cheaper, inferior goods into more expensive goods and you sell it as if it's all expensive materials. And the Tosefta, after talking a little more in detail, says, Shemalin alav, she'ilu hayayachal ligno das ha'elyona hayagonev. If the person could have deceived God, he would do so also. And then, she'kalagonev das habrios nikra ganav. Anybody who deceives people is called a ganav. She'nemar v'yignov avshalom eslev anshei Yisrael. He deceived them with his intentions, of the way he felt, to endear himself to them. He was a ganav. The Tosefta here paints a very broad picture of Genevas Das. On the one hand, we have a deception which I would term as theft in social commerce. And that's considered Geneva, despite the fact that there is no obvious or immediate financial deceit or gain involved. On the other hand, we have cases of cheating in a monetary sense, such as weights and measures, which are more classic forms of theft involving money. And they're also described as Genevas Das. They're not described as standard Genevas Mamon, probably because the transfer of property, in this case, is done with the consent, albeit the fraudulently induced consent, of the person who's being cheated, as opposed to my walking into his house and stealing, walking in straight out stealing, instead I deceive him in order to relieve him of his money. The primary discussion of the laws of Genevas Das is found in Perikid Anoshe, the 7th chapter of Maseches Chulin. And there, we read in the Gemara the basic prohibition in source number 3, Omar Shmuel, Osir Ligno Das Abrios, one is not allowed to deceive people, Va'afilu Dato Shel Goy, even a non-Jew. There is a position in the Gemara, one which is rejected, La Halacha, that Gezel Hagoy is mutter. That position is not accepted. But even according to that position, Genevas Das, deception of a non-Jew, that is prohibited. The Gemara continues citing a brisa that is very similar to the Tosefta that we read, but it has some extra words in it and has some explanatory commentary in it. And the Tosefta here and the Gemara that follows provides us with some exceptions to the rule of Genevas Das, situations in which actions that might otherwise be prohibited are actually permitted. And in source 4, the Gemara states, Tanya Hayy Rabbi Meir Omer, Al Yisariv Adam Lachaver Lisot Etzlo V'Yodea Bo She'en Osoe. We saw that line in the Tosefta. V'lo Yarba Lo B'Tikroves V'Yodea Bo She'en Amakabel. To push him to accept a gift, to accept an invitation, you know he's not going to accept it. V'lo Yiftach Lo Chavios HaMachuras L'Chenvani. You shouldn't open for him barrels that you've already sold to the Chenvani, to the shopkeeper, to the merchant. Ella im kein hodio, unless you let him know, by the way, these barrels, you know, will enjoy some good wine, but don't feel bad for me, I'm not going to lose any money on this, because I've sold the rest of the wine, whatever remains in the barrel, the chenvani is going to buy from me. Velo yomar lo soch shem en mipach reikon. Don't offer him an empty vial of oil to anoint himself with, because there's nothing in there, it's not a genuine offer. But then, Tosef the Brisa says, V'im b'shvil kvodo mutar. If the purpose of this offer is not to deceive him but to honor him, then it's mutar. We'll explain a little more later about that. So now the Gemara presents a challenge to this brisa. Is it really true that you're not allowed to open barrels for someone without letting him know? V'ha'ula ikla lebei Rav Yehuda. Ula was invited, he was a guest in the house of Rav Yehuda. End of story. He opened for him barrels that already had been sold. So how, the assumption is that Rabbi Yehuda, who was a great Amora, would not have violated Genevas Das. So how can it be that opening these barrels in such a case would be awesome? The Gemara gives two answers. The first answer is that you didn't tell the whole story. Odoe, odae. The end of the story is Rabbi Yehuda told Ula, he said, you know, I have these barrels, they're not opened yet, but I've sold it already, so why don't we open it now? Tomorrow I'll give the rest to the merchant, and let's enjoy it now. So there was no deception involved. V'iboyesema, if you want, you can give a different answer, the Gemara says. Shani Ula, dechaviv lei l'Rav Yehuda. Ula was such a dear friend of Rav Yehuda's. Dibelav hachi pesuche miftachlei. That even if the rest of this barrel was going to go to waste, he would have opened it anyway. He was so delighted to host Ula in his house, he would have wasted the entire barrel if it had been necessary. It turns out it wasn't necessary, but the fact is he would have done it anyway. And therefore, he wasn't doing anything that was deceptive. So the Brisa here has articulated what might be called three exceptions to the rule of Genevas Das, three circumstances in which the action is permitted. The first, and in some sense it's not really an exception, but rather what we might call avoidance, is if you inform the person. If you let the person know that you're not going to suffer financial loss on the rest of the wine barrel because it's been sold to a shopkeeper, the person will not think that you're doing him such a nice favor and being so kind and showing him such honor. But in effect, it's not that it's an exception to the rule, but rather you simply fill in all the facts and the person understands and there's no Genevas Das. The second focuses on the intent of the actor. If the intent is to create the impression that you are doing something nice on a person's behalf, so that you will elicit some kind of goodwill in return, and that presumably will result in some kind of payback in the future. I invite you for a meal because I know that you cook. Wonderful food. I know you're not going to come, but I know I'll get an invitation in return at some point. I'll get something else from you. So if the intent is not to elicit that goodwill under false pretenses, then it is a violation of Genevas Das. But if the primary and the real intent was to honor the person, as Rashi suggests, by demonstrating in front of others that the high esteem in which you hold that person, then it would be permitted. In this vein, it's worth noting Rashi's definition of Genevas Das, because finding a definition is always hard, and specifically the definition of Genevas Das, what I term is social commerce. And I paraphrase Rashi here, it's not on the source sheet. Rashi writes, Shesavur Sheze Ohavomaod. The person, the recipient of this action, thinks that he really likes me, he's my friend. Vinimsa Mahazik Lo Tova Bechinam. And what he gives back in exchange is he's grateful to the person. And presumably, again, this has hashlachot, this has ramifications at a later point. Thus, in our case, since the actor has acted with the benefit of the recipient in mind, lechvodo, he has not ingratiated himself to the recipient, bechinam, to use Rashi's language. In a sense, any benefit he accrues from doing this is in lieu of the fact that he genuinely acted on behalf of the recipient. Which is to say, that he did something for the benefit of the recipient, but in this case, it's not what the recipient actually thought, it's something else. But nonetheless, it's not a totally mistaken impression. That's the second exception. The third exception also depends upon the intent of the actor, but not in this specific situation, but rather on one's general disposition. Rabbi Yehuda was quite fond of Ullah. And if Ullah had been visiting in a situation where Rabbi Yehuda had not already sold the barrel to a merchant, he would have opened the barrel anyway. And he would have suffered the financial loss that such an action would have entailed. And thus, to use Rashi's definition again, Ullah would be grateful to Rabbi Yehuda because he would think that Rabbi Yehuda was his ohev, he was his good friend. And in fact, this would be a correct impression. Rabbi Yehuda was his friend, and Rabbi Yehuda would open a barrel just for Ullah's benefit, even if it entailed a significant financial loss. It happens to be in this case it didn't, but the impression that Rabbi Yehuda was creating about his relationship with Ullah was not a false impression. There is one more significant exception to the rule of Gneivas Das that emerges from a passage on the next Amud in the Gemara, Daf Tzadi Dalet Amud Beis. The Gemara there says as follows in source number 5. The Gemara speaks about a practice that we have today as well, although today it's done a little differently. When you shecht an animal and you botch the shechita, or the animal turns out to be a treifa, it has an internal problem, and it's not kosher, so you sell the meat to a non-Jew. So in those days, it wasn't done on a commercial scale. You might have had one animal that day in the town that was a treifa, and you would sell it to non-Jews, and the Gemara asks, Hechi machrazinan, how do you advertise, how do you announce the availability of non-kosher meat for non-Jew? Amar Rabbi Yitzchak bar Yosef, nofal bisra levnei chela. Meat has become available for the quartered soldiers. So the Gemara asks, v'lema nofal treifa levnei chela? Why don't you say there's some non-kosher meat available for the non-Jews? And treifa is not just non-kosher, but it implies, you know, the truth is nothing wrong with the treifa, the meat is just as good, but, you know, it sounds like it's not so good. So the Gemara says, lo zabni, because then they won't buy it. Because, you know, you put a not nice label, not nice packaging, they won't buy it. So the Gemara says, v'hakamati lehu, but then you're deceiving them. How can you do that? So the Gemara responds by saying, inuhu dekamatu anafshaihi. They are deceiving themselves. You're not fooling them. Now, what it sounds like is that you didn't say anything inherently deceptive. They make some type of an error. Now, we're going to discuss in a few moments what exactly is, how do you define the difference between deceiving someone and someone making the error themselves. So we'll talk about that in a moment. But now the Gemara tells a story. Ki hada mar zutra bereid Rav Nachman hava ka'azu misichra lebe mechoza. Mar zutra was going from sichra to be mechoza. V'rava v'rasafra hava ka'asu lesichra. They were going in the other direction. Padu adadi, they run into each other. Hu savar, mar zutra thinks to himself, not clear why, La'apehu dekasu, they're coming to meet me. Amar lehu, he says to them, Lamalahu l'rabbanan d'taruach v'aso kulehai. It's so nice of you, but you really didn't have to go out of your way so much just to greet me. So Rasafra can't keep his mouth closed. And he says, Amar le Rasafra, anan lohayin adinan dekasimar. We didn't know that you were coming. Okay. A little, burst his bubble a little bit. But had we known, we would have come even more so. We certainly would have gone farther. We would have gone farther out of our way to see, to greet you. Amar le Rava, Rava turns to Rav Safra and says, Oy, my time, Amar Slehachi, why did you tell him that? You made him feel bad. Amar le, so Rav Safra says innocently, Hakamatina le, but we're deceiving him. So Rava responds, Ihu hu de kamate nashe. No, he deceived himself. We didn't deceive him. So what exactly, what does this mean? What is the standard of deception? The Gemara here clearly asserts that there's a fundamental distinction between a case in which you deceive another person and a case in which the person deceives him or herself. The crucial question is as follows. If you perform an action and someone else is deceived by that action, how do you apportion the blame for the deception? With regard to this issue, we find three opinions amongst the Rishonim. Rashi, on the spot, writes, Inuhu dekamatu anafshayu, with respect to the quartered soldiers, Rashi writes, Delo mishayli itrefa ikshera. They didn't ask. You announced there's meat available for the quartered soldiers. He comes in to buy. He doesn't say, is this kosher or non-kosher meat? He comes in to buy it. You didn't say anything. You didn't deceive him. Now, v'haydi katani le'el m'nei shemateyu, earlier in a Gemara that we didn't see, the Gemara said you're not allowed to sell a non-kosher meat to a Gentile in certain circumstances because you're deceiving him. M'nei shemateyu, that's b'mochel lo b'cheska shkuta, when you give him the impression that this is kosher meat. Similarly, if you open barrels that were already opened, that were already sold to the chenvani, the omer lo b'shvilcha ani poscham. If you tell him, I have some good barrels of wine. I'm going to open them. I like you so much. Let's open them now. So then, the vanai donedat. Of course, you're deceiving him. But in this case, Rav and Rav Safra, they didn't say anything to Mar Zutra. The people who announced the meat just said that there's meat available for the quartered soldiers. They didn't say it was kosher meat. They didn't say it was non-kosher meat. So Rashi here appears to understand, certainly the way, I think this is what Rashi does say, and Tosos understands him this way, that the question depends upon the verbalization of the party who might be deceiving. If he says something that leads to the deception that creates the errant impression, then he is in violation of Gneivas Das. But if he is silent, or certainly if he says nothing that is verbally misleading, then no violation can be committed. Tosfos, however, cites Rashi, and he strongly disagrees. Tosfos, in source number 7, writes in the middle of the second line, V'ein nireh. He then quotes Rashi, and he thinks that Rashi is wrong. The ha ella imkein hodio katani. The Gemara earlier had said that Gneivas Das, it's usher to open these barrels unless you let the person know. You have to tell him, I'm not doing this as a special favor for you. Demashma afilu bistam usher. It sounds as if you didn't say anything, so you didn't let him know, but you didn't say anything either in the opposite direction, that it would be usher. And it would be prohibited. Veloshari ela b'chiya gavna. It's only permitted if you explicitly tell him that you're not doing it on his behalf. That's number one. V'od, and I think a more compelling question. V'od, the mai parach me Rab Yehuda the pasach le'ula. How could the Gemara earlier have asked a question about Rabbi Yehuda's behavior with Ula? Vaday shelo hayamat eyu Rabbi Yehuda lomer lo b'shvich ani poschan. It's inconceivable that Rabbi Yehuda verbally and purposely misled Ula? Well, the Gemara thought that that's what Rabbi Yehuda did? According to Rashi, Rabbi Yehuda didn't have to say anything one way or the other. He could, according to Rashi, if Rabbi Yehuda said nothing, and he opened the barrels and gave Ula to drink, that should have been permissible because he said he didn't verbalize anything. So Tosos thinks that Rashi's not correct. And instead, Tosos says, Lekach nireh, therefore it would appear, the hasam bistam, in a normal case, if you don't say anything, it would be usur. Why? Mishum de'ein la'oreach la'asuke adaite de'mechuros l'chenvani. There's no reason why the oreach should think that these barrels are already sold to a chenvani. I go into your house, I assume that most of the barrels of wine that you have are your barrels. You haven't already arranged to sell them. If you had arranged to sell them, you probably would have delivered them already. So I don't assume that you're opening it, that you've sold it to a chenvani, and therefore when you open it, it's reasonable for me to assume that you're doing it on my behalf. Aval hacha, in the case of the story of the Bnei Chela and of Mar Zutra, ibaylu lasuke adaita the trefahi. It was an unreasonable error that the soldiers made to assume that it would be unreasonable to assume that it's specifically kosher meat. Umar Zutra ibaylu lasuke adaita shelo lekraso hayuba elal tzarachatzvan. And Mar Zutra should have considered the possibility, and probably in fact they should have concluded that they weren't coming out to greet him. But rather, they were coming out to go on their way, and it was just an accident or a chance. Thus, according to Tosfos, there is what we might call a standard of reasonable error. If a person makes a reasonable assumption in error, then to allow the impression to persist constitutes a violation of Gnevas Das. If, however, the deceived party makes an unreasonable assumption, then there is no Gnevas Das, and there is no obligation to clarify the situation. This standard, of course, is not easily defined. Reasonable minds might disagree on what is a reasonable error and what is an unreasonable error, but nonetheless, this is the standard that Tosos defines. There is possibly a third opinion, that of Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom was printed on the side of the Gemara in Chulin, source number 8, the second paragraph from Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom says, Iuhud kamate yanashe. This is talking about the story of Narzutra. And Rabbeinu Gershom says, Klomar, shehu yodea delo nafkinan lekadamusei. He knows we're not coming out to greet him, despite the fact that he says, oh, how nice of you to come greet me. He knows that's not why we're coming. V'afal pikein amar amayin tzdai rabbanu. You know, sometimes people say things to sort of flatter themselves, to make themselves feel better. So according to Rabbeinu Gershom, there was no error on Marzutra's part. And what Rava was saying to Rav Safra was, just be quiet. Let him tell that to himself. Let him say that. Don't make him feel bad. But it sounds from Rabbeinu Gershom that if in fact Marzutra had in fact made an error, and Marzutra genuinely thought that they were coming to greet him, to honor him, that in fact Rav Safra would have been correct. They would have been obligated to tell Marzutra. Rabbeinu Gershom assumes that not only is creating a misimpression verbally prohibited, that's according to Rashi, and not only is allowing a reasonable misimpression to stand, as according to Tosfos, prohibited, but even an unreasonable assumption in any situation where there is a misimpressed party, someone who's under a misimpression, even because of their own doing, to allow that misimpression to stand is prohibited, is a violation of Gnevas Das. Rabbeinu Gershom's position, if I understand it correctly, and his interpretation of this story may find support in two sources. First is the story itself. Think about the story for a moment. What do you think was actually going to happen after Rav and Rav Safra met Marzutra? Well, Marzutra was going this way. Rav and Rav Safra were going that way. They said hello. They greeted each other. The next step was Marzutra was going to keep going that way, and Rav and Rav Safra were going to keep going the other way. I assume moments later, it was going to be obvious to Marzutra that he had made a mistake. And so no deception, if Marzutra didn't already know it when he ran into them, he certainly was going to find it out in 30 seconds. Now, Rabbeinu Gershom would understand that Rava's point of Safra was as follows. Yes, you don't have to say anything to him. He knows it already. If he doesn't know, he'll find out in 10 seconds. But you know what? If we do it to him, it's more embarrassing. If we go on our own merry way and we don't see him again, and he goes the other way, he's going to feel a little sheepish because now he really knows that that wasn't the case. But you don't have to burst this bubble. You don't have to do that to him. But it does seem clear from the story that at least the end result is that Marzutra was going to find out anyway. And that would seem to be support Rabbeinu Gershom's reading. The second supporting text for this position, if I'm correct, even if I'm not correct, it being Rabbeinu Gershom's position, but it certainly would point in this direction, is a passage in the Yerushalmi found in Shviyas and Makos. Just a brief piece of background. If a person kills someone accidentally under certain circumstances, he is obligated to flee to exile in Ari Miklat, in cities of refuge. If he arrives in a city of refuge, and the people there are not aware of the fact that he's a murderer, instead they assume he's just a visiting rabbi, and they want to call him up for shlishi, he has to say to them, Rotzeach ani. V'zed divar harotzeach. Chazal understand divar is a lashon of dibur, speech. He has to tell them, you know, I'm not here as a visiting a scholar in residence. I'm here because I was forced to flee because I accidentally killed someone. If the townspeople wish to honor him anyway, they may do so, and that's fine. But he has to tell them. In light of this, the Yerushalmi comments as follows. Amar Rabbi Yose, source number 9. Hado Amra, Zos Omeris, this teaches us, Barnash de Tani Chada Michla, If you have an individual who has learned one Masechta, he's a Baki in one Masechta in Shas, who azal la'asar, he goes to a place, the inun mokrin lei begain tarti, so a person who is a Baki in one Masechta, he gets Chamishi. But if you're a Baki in two Masechtas, you get Shlishi. So they want to call him up, the Gabbai comes up to him, wants to give him Shlishi. He wants to honor him as if he's someone who knows two Masechtas. Sarach Meimarlon, he has to say to them, Anachada Michla Anachacham. I only know one Masechta. If they want to give him Shlishi anyway, that's fine. But he has to tell them. Now, here the townspeople seem to have made what is a completely unreasonable error. And yet, the Yerushalmi claims that the person is obligated to clarify. It's not like he walked in with a sign on his head that said, I'm a Baki in two Masechtas, and it wasn't true. Guy walks into a town and they, for some reason, make a mistake. So if we don't accept the position of Ravenu Gershon, and the Shulchan Aruch doesn't, what are we to make of this Yerushalmi? So there's a tshuva of the Maharit, who's a late 16th, early 17th century Achron who lived in Constantinople, who, in the middle of a tshuva, as an aside, addresses this issue. And he writes after, I start reading after the first ellipsis, but the words Ela the Kasha Liba. He says, Ela the Kasha Liba, the Habiperik Giranoshe Muchach, the Cholhecha de Inu Matu Nafshayu, Lo Shayach Genevas Das. That when a person, the Gemara makes clear, if a person deceives himself, makes a silly error, so there's no Genevas Das involved. Lomi boy in the Rashi Zal Shapiresh Deleka Genevas Das Ela B'Mocher Trefa B'Cheska Shluta. Not only according to Rashi, Ela Lafilu L'Manda Amrim Shechokulav. Even according to Tosfos, who argue in Rashi, V'Amru and said, Ach Bistam Shayach Genevas Das. Even if you don't say anything, there can still be Genevas Das. Hecha De Lohav Alei LaHakiro LaSuke Adaite. When they made a reasonable error, so in this case. In this case, even for Tosafos, this shouldn't be Genevas Das. He didn't tell them that he's such a big Baki. So the Maharit answers as follows. That when they praise him in front of him, and praise him as someone who is a Baki in two Masechtas, as someone who deserves that honor, the Shosek, and then in response to their praise, he remained silent. The Mishtikasa Toam Bakah. You know what? Their first error was unreasonable. It was unreasonable to assume that he knew two Masechtas. But when they start to praise him and tell him, we are so honored to have someone who knows two Masechtas in our town, and he just smiles and says, thank you. Well, you know, now a reasonable person would assume that their original assumption was in fact correct. So now he's violating Genevas Das. In effect, what the Maharit is saying is that if someone makes an unreasonable assumption about you in the abstract, that you don't need to clarify. But if they are going to act upon that mistaken assumption and reward you, then the expectation that people have is that you're going to clarify the error, and to not do so at that point reinforces their error in a manner which renders their continued errant assumption a reasonable one, and hence Genevas Das. So for example, if I were to stop here, and you were to walk away assuming that I am a Baki in Shelus Utshuvos, because I know this obscure tshuva of the Maharit, so that would be okay. That would be your error, assuming that just because I know this one tshuva, that I know all of the others. But if you decide to offer me shlishi in shul, which you normally reserve for someone who is a tremendous baki, then I'd be obliged to tell you that at this point that I have no such bakias, and that my knowledge of this tshuva was just the result of a computer and a little bit of hard work, but I don't have such bakias. So the Maharit explains how the Yerushalmi can be read even in light of the standard position of Tosfos. The Shulchan Aruch in Choshen Mishpat Simen Reish Chav Ches, source number 14, cites the basic rules of Genevas Das and rules in accordance with the opinion of Tosfos on the dispute that we've already discussed. The Shulchan Aruch writes, and I'll read quickly, Asur l'ramos b'nei adam b'mekach u'memkar o lignov datam. You can't deceive people in commerce, or to be gonev das, kigonim yeshemum b'mekho tzarech lo dilo kech. If the goods are defective, then you have to tell them. Achamu obet kochab miyim v'tzenanju, lo yimka lo basar neveilim cheska shkuta. You can't sell a non-kosher meat and pass it off as kosher meat. Va'ach lignov das habriyos bedvarim, to deceive people only with what we call social commerce, is also prohibited. Shemare she'ose b'shvilo v'eino ose. It's all awesome. Ketzad, and he quotes the examples from the Gemara, Lo Yisari She Yisov Imo, Hu Yodea Sheino Soed, Velo Yarbelo Bitikrobes, Hu Yodea Sheino Mekabel, Velo Yifta Chavios Apsuchos Lechenvoni, Vizet Sover Shepsachem Beshvilo, Eletzarech Lo Dio Shelo Psachem Beshvilo. So he quotes the heter of letting the other person know. And then he does say one more thing. Then Hu Dovar, the Iboy Le La Suke Yadaite, Sheino Ose Beshvilo. If it is something that the person should know that he's not doing it on his behalf, umata atzma, when he's deceiving himself, shasova shaoso b'shvilo l'chvodo, kigon shepaga b'chaver b'derech, this is the story of Mar Zotra, b'savar zesh shayotza l'kras l'chvodo, l'chavdo, ein sarach l'hodiyo. Okay, so basically, the Mechaber here quotes the heter of hodiyo, if you let the person know. He quotes the position of Tosfos, that if the person makes an unreasonable error, that you don't have to clarify, and in the next sif, which is not printed here, he quotes the heter of lichvodo. He does not, by the way, the Shulchan Aruch does not quote the heter if you would have done it anyway for the person, and that's discussed by the Acharonim whether that leniency applies. Okay. Up until this point, we have focused primarily on issues of Gnevas Das that are not of the financial variety. But in the realm of the financial variety, there are no limits to the kind of dishonesty that exists. The Tosefta that we read earlier spoke about cheating in weights and measures, diluting produce. Not mentioned there would be things like false advertising, even when no money changes hands. The Tosefta in Bava Metzia comments, and this is source 13, Lo yarbitz chenvani leso chanuso yayin b'shem meishagone das abriyo. So you're not allowed to create an impression that your store has very fancy goods when in fact it doesn't have any such goods. And even though the person is going to walk in, is going to find out that in fact you don't have such nice goods, that you're really just a 99-cent store, it's still prohibited to do so. That's Gnevas Das. Okay. But having explored the basic technical aspects of Gnevas Das, there is even more importantly a moral dimension which goes beyond the halacha. The effect that such behavior has on the soul and character of the person who lies or engages in deceptive behavior. There's a very, very interesting passage in the Gemara in Yevamos, Daf Samach Gimel Amud Aleph. The Gemara speaks about Rav and his difficult marriage. His wife was, he had a very difficult relationship. His wife, if you would ask him to make one thing for, make her rice for dinner, she would make pasta. If he'd ask her to make pasta, she'd make rice. Rav just accepted this. One day, his son Chia grew up, and sometimes Chia would bring his father's instructions to his mother, his father's request to his mother. And all of a sudden, Mrs. Rav started getting things right. He would ask for rice, and she would get right, and he would get rice. He would ask for pasta, and he would get pasta. So Rav says to Chia, his son, he said, you know, your mother's getting better. So Chia says, no, that's because I reverse your instructions. When you ask for rice, I tell her pasta, so she makes rice, and so on and so forth. Rav looks at this and says, my son is smarter than I am. I should have figured this out a long time ago. But then he tells his son, don't do it. Why? Because limdu l'shonam daber sheker havei nilu. Even though technically speaking it's permitted, this is mishan and mitmei hashalom, nonetheless you are teaching yourself to speak dishonestly. The Navi in Yirmiyahu speaks about at the time of the Churban how the Jews had taught themselves to speak sheker, they would twist themselves and engage in great effort to find crooked schemes. If this is true with regards to lying that is technically permissible and done for a noble cause, shalom bayis, how much more so is for the case for lying and deception for personal financial gain? And those who would think to draw a distinction between Jew and non-Jew in these matters, as halachically indefensible and morally loathsome as that is, should realize that even in their twisted worldview, those who habitually cheat non-Jews will come to do the same to Jews. If they become habitually dishonest with non-Jews, then they will do ha'avein elu. They will struggle to rationalize the same behavior with Jews. Rabbeinu Yonah in Shari Tshuva picks up on this point, and he writes, source number 16, Mi shemases chaveiro lemor ki asa imotova odiber tovala v'loasa. Someone who deceives his friend and makes him think that he did something nice for him, that he spoke well of him. Amar Rabbi Oseinu, this is a kind of sheker, he's a member of the Kas HaShakarim, the group of liars. Amar Rabbi Oseinu Zal, Osir lignov dasa brius hafilu das nachri. You can't deceive anybody, even a non-Jew. V'hinei hachet hazecham or eitzel chachmei Yisrael. It is more severe for the Jewish sages. Yosem yigezal nachri. Worse than straight out theft.
Yan uviyan because kisva sheker ashmaraba.
A lying speech, a lying tongue, is a hot, is a terrible sin. It's a grave sin.
V'nischayavnu al gidrei ha'emes.
We are obligated to stay within the fences of truth. Kihumi yisodei ha'nefesh. It is an essential component of the soul. The Rambam in Hilchos Deos codifies the prohibition of Mevis Das as follows.
Osir la'adam lahanig atzmo v'divrei chalakos upitui.
A person may not conduct oneself with deceit, dishonesty, with flattery,
v'lo yiyeh echad b'pev echad b'lev.
You shouldn't say one thing and mean another.
Ela tocho kevaro. What's inside should be what's on the outside. V'inyin shebelev v'adavar shebepev.
And then he says, it's asur ligno dasa brias afilu dasa nachri, and he quotes the examples. All the examples that the Gemara has. And when you get to the end, the last line,
vafilu mila achashopitu,
even one word of flattery, b'shal genevas das, of deception, is asur. It's prohibited.
Ela svas emes v'ruach nachon,
a truthful speech, and a straight spirit, and a leivtar, a pure heart, a heart pure, mikol amol vavos, of all chicanery, of all deceptions. It is perhaps telling that the Rambam, when he codifies the general prohibition of Genevas Das, that he does it in Hilchos Deos. He doesn't put this in Hilchos Geneva. He puts it in Hilchos Deos, because Hilchos Deos is about ethics and character. Because while technically speaking, Genevas Das is a form of Geneva, even more so, it is a mark of degenerate character. But there is another dimension which the issues of Genevas Das raise, something which is vexing and difficult to, when dealing with Genevas Das and its exceptions. Putting aside the first exception, that of telling the other person, which is very straightforward, the other three exceptions, which are doing it to honor the person, not to get false goodwill, or that you would have done it anyway for the person, or that the other person is deceiving himself, are all things that are highly subjective and are subject to errors in judgment. In the case of the first two, your motivation, doing it to honor him, or you would have done it anyway, these things fall under the category of what Chazal call dvarim hamesurim lelev, things that are given over to a person's heart. There are five places in Sefer Vayikra where the Torah attaches to prohibition the statement of v'yareisa me'elokecha, you must fear God. The Sifra, the Medrash Halacha on Vayikra, explains that the Torah issues this warning in situations where the Torah proscribes behavior whose outward action is inherently ambiguous. We are warned, for example, not to place a stumbling block in front of the blind. This includes giving a person bad advice. You can give advice sincerely that goes bad, or you can give the advice knowing that it's bad, perhaps because there's an angle from which you can benefit. The only one who can judge the intent of this action, besides the person himself, is the Almighty. And that's why it said, V'yareisa me'elokecha. This is the test of a God-fearing Jew. There's a famous story in Brachos at the end of the fourth parak. When Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was on his deathbed, it's one of the last sources, source 19. His Talmidim made one last request of him. They said, Rabbeinu Barchenu, Rebbe, please bless us. Give us a bracha. Amar lahem, he said to them, it's at the end of the source, Yehi ratzon shetehemora shamayim aleichem kemora vasar v'dam. It should be his will that his fear should be upon you, that your fear of God should be equal to your fear of man. So his very frum and pious Talmidim said to him, Rebbe, they said, Ad kan, that's it? We should only fear God as much as we fear man? Amar lahem, he looks at them and says, Ulevai, if only. Teidu, you should know, kisha adam over avera omer shelo yirani adam. When a person is about to sin, his instinct is to look if anybody else is watching him. His instinct is not to think, is God watching me? And if a person feared God only as much as he feared other people, that would be a mark of Yiras Shamayim. In many cases, we deal with actions which, if public, would be shameful. But with respect to Genevas Das, some of these things, even if done publicly, would be morally ambiguous. And this requires a most genuine level of Yiras Shamayim. After everything that I've said this evening and the entire discussion of certain aspects of the laws of Genevas Das and the details, there is a part of me that is reluctant to talk about these things, to talk about halachic details, about ethical issues, for a simple reason. Because there is a part of the culture of our community, the Torah community,
for which the details simply become an excuse to find loopholes. One of the most striking things to me is that in a culture dedicated to nuances and details, which can find the most amazing chumras in trivial matters, the same culture seems unable to take that approach in ethical issues. I doubt anybody is going to suggest that we should be machmir for Rabbeinu Gershom, or that we should be yotzei all the shitas in paying our taxes. And I don't mean to suggest that shenanigans are only the province of lamdanim from Jews. There is more than enough financial chicanery and dishonesty to go around amongst non-lamdanim, amongst non-from Jews, amongst non-Jews. But there are two things that are profoundly disturbing about dishonesty when it comes from Anshei Shlomeinu. Firstly, one would like to believe that the study of Torah would serve to make a person's character more noble and elevated. If a person spends hours and hours studying Torah and can leave the base medrash and figure out how he can beat the system or the latest clever chap not to be a straight arrow, what's the point? The Gemara in Yoma, the Chaim Beis, makes clear that Torah is a means to an end. The end is Yirah Shamayim, is fear of God. If one's Torah doesn't lead to greater Yirah Shamayim, then one would be better off not studying Torah. As Rava put it to his students, why should you suffer in both worlds? You deny yourself in this world as a Ben Torah, and then you have no portion in Olam Haba. The second part, which I find even more disturbing, is the frequent use of Halacha and Torah to justify such behavior. On rare occasion, I've had the experience of having a contractor who offered me to pay in cash and to save the sales tax. I refuse, and I must admit that I'm not a personality to lecture someone, so I just quietly refuse. But I have the feeling, the sneaking feeling, that if I were to ask the contractor, he would thought this is really okay. He wouldn't say to me that his priest or his pastor told him that it was mutter. Unfortunately, that would not always be the case if one were dealing with observant Jews. And they wouldn't always be making it up when they said that their rabbi told them it was mutter. And for this reason, when I look at two of the major scandals that hurt our community in the past year, the Madoff scandal and the money laundering accusations, on a spiritual existential level, one troubles me very little, even if it hurt us a lot more financially, and one troubles me greatly. I'm not troubled by the Madoff affair in an existential sense. That he was Jewish was accidental. It was incidental. His Judaism and his Jewishness had nothing to do with this fraud. He was a crook, a talented crook, unfortunately, who happened to have been Jewish. But the accusations against a number of rabbis, and right now they're just accusations, are more troubling. If true, they are not just incidental to the alleged perpetrator's Judaism. The attitudes espoused by many in the firm world, and I should caution that these attitudes exist in the modern Orthodox community as well, towards the non-Jewish world and towards business matters and halacha, generally are major contributing factors. The alleged acts are undoubtedly halachically forbidden, both from an internal halachic perspective and from the perspective of Dina Malchus Adina. There's no need to elaborate now. But the violations are natural outgrowths of unacceptably permissive attitudes towards business matters and morally pernicious attitudes towards anyone who is not unserer, anyone who is not us. And even if these allegations turn out to be untrue, we are all too painfully aware of some of the violations which are routine in parts of the Frum community under the rubric of being mutter. The Mishnah in Shabbos speaks of someone whose house is on fire, and there's no danger to life, you're not allowed to extinguish the fire. And the whole question discussed by the Mishnah is what you're allowed to take out of the house, what you're allowed to save. And the Mishnah restricts those things that you can carry out into the yard, for fear that a person in his haste, who's bohu al mamono, he might extinguish by accident and violate a malacha on Shabbos. So the Mishnah states that a person may save only the amount of food for three meals for Shabbos, for himself, for his family, and no more food. If he keeps making trips back in, he's just going to panic and extinguish the fire. But the Mishnah says he can also invite other people to save food for themselves. Va'omer la'acherim, the Mishnah says, bohu va'atzilu lachem. Come, take some food for yourselves. Now, halachically speaking, at that point, the rest of the food in the house, because he can't save it for himself, is halachically hefter. It's ownerless. Anybody who takes it becomes the rightful owner. Then the Mishnah says something amazing. V'im hoyu pikchin, if they were clever, astute people, osin imo cheshbon achar Shabbos, they won't keep the food for themselves. They'll make a cheshbon after Shabbos that he should pay them just for their effort, just for their tircha in taking the food out, but they'll give him the food. Note what the Mishnah considers a pikeach. Some people understand that the immediate gain versus the long-term cost of a clever, conniving community is a long-term loss. And it is worth adding to this point that if once upon a time such behavior was a survival mechanism for many of us, in Jewish communities that lived on the margins, it is no longer necessary or acceptable. Today it seems to me that someone who would not take advantage of financial opportunities by most people would not be called a pikeach. He would be called a shoteh, a nar. The fact is, though, that so many of these opportunities are halachic violations and are not, in fact, mutter. But even if chas v'chalila they were, we would still be missing the point. There is a very powerful passage in the Yerushalmi which serves as one of the sources for the smag that I opened tonight's shir with. The Yerushalmi speaks about the law of Avedus Atam, the lost object of a non-Jew. According to the Gemara, one is not obligated to return the lost object of the non-Jew. For multiple reasons, this is not applicable today, starting with Dina the Malchus of Dina, but assume for the moment that in the context of the Gemara, it was permitted. So the Yerushalmi tells the following story, and I will just, for the moment, translate. Shimon ben Shetach used to work, once upon a time, rabbis actually didn't make money from the rabbinate. They earned their parnassah by working with their hands, and they didn't take a salary. Okay, so unfortunately, we don't live that way anymore. But that was the reality. Shimon ben Shetach used to work with flax. A terrible profession. People dealt with it there. Very, very unpleasant. His student said to him, Rebbe, you're working too hard. You know, give us a chance, and we'll buy you a donkey, and you won't have to work so hard. You'll be a donkey driver, like a truck driver, instead of having to work with flax. Okay, so he accepted their suggestion, so they went and they bought him a donkey. They bought it from a non-Jew, and then they noticed that there was this incredibly expensive jewel hanging from the animal's neck. They brought it back to their Rebbe, and they said, Rebbe, you're never going to have to work another day in your life, because look what's hanging on its neck. So he turns to his talmid and he says, did the owner know about it? They said, no. He said, take it back to him. But they said, Rebbe, even the one who says that stealing from a non-Jew is usur, everybody agrees that his lost object is permitted. You don't have to return it. Shimon ben Shetach responded, and he said, what do you think? Do you think that Shimon ben Shetach, and I quote literally, is a barbarian, is a barbaron? In that world, there were two kinds of people. There was a barbaron, and there was a Hellene. There was a barbarian, an uncivilized human being, and there was a Hellenized, a Greek, a civilized person. He says, do you think I'm some kind of uncivilized barbarian? I would much rather hear the Gentile give praise to the God of the Jews, who are such a wonderful and honest people, than anything I could possibly receive in this world. We have a choice. We can act like Shimon ben Shetach's clever Talmidim, barbarians, or we can choose the path of civilized human beings like Shimon ben Shetach. I know that storytelling is a very popular genre these days. So I wanted to tell two stories. One took place about 300 years ago, something like that. It's the subject of a tshuva that someone once pointed out to me that was written by the Noda Yehuda to representatives of the Kaiser. It's a painful tshuva. Apparently a Jew had engaged in some financial transaction where he had taken an oath to agree to something. And now he wanted to back out. And he made the following claim. When he had taken the oath, the Shvua, he had put his hand on a Sefer Torah, which turned out to be Pasul. And he wanted to claim that since the Sefer Torah was Pasul, his oath was not binding. The Noda Yehuda, in one of the most unusual tshuvas I've ever read, spends the first half of the tshuva just quoting verse after verse from Torah and Nevi'im, which speaks about the abomination of false oaths, the prohibition of false oaths, and he just says, and nowhere does it say that you have to be holding a holy object when you take the oath. Nikitas chefetz is not necessary for an oath to be binding. He has some very other clever observations as well, but I don't need to share them now. This was Jewish behavior. It's not worthy of emulating. But then there's another story, a story that I find very moving and inspirational, a story that happened recently. There's a student in the yeshiva who was preparing for next year. He was applying to graduate schools. And he had very restricted options. He was counting upon it for financial support. And basically he had one place he could go because of family considerations, and he didn't get in. Now you can imagine, in this economy, it doesn't look good. It's April, it's May, and you don't know what you're doing for the next year. And his spouse was in school. You've got to put food on the table. A position came up very late in a local yeshiva. And he went through several interviews. And eventually, the institution was ready to offer him a job. They had two candidates. One who was more experienced, but they thought probably not going to be as good of a mechanech. And this particular student in the yeshiva. And then they threw a curveball at him at an interview. His last interview, they're about ready to give him the job. And they asked him, what are his plans beyond this coming year? And he wasn't sure, but he thought he might apply to more graduate schools because he'd have more freedom the year after. He didn't answer the question. He didn't say anything untruthful. But he didn't indicate to them that he was not necessarily committed to remaining in the school beyond the year. But I should note that the school never made a commitment to him beyond the year either. But they were concerned because they thought they would invest some resources in the student. And, you know, maybe he would leave after a year. It wasn't worth it for them. They'd rather take the other teacher, even if the other teacher wouldn't be as good, if there would be some continuity and so on. The student came to his Rebbe the next day, and he asked him a shaila. He was very troubled. What is he supposed to do? His Rebbe wasn't exactly sure. The situation, at least on the surface, appears to be somewhat ambiguous. So his Rebbe sent him to his own Rebbe. And his own Rebbe, the Rebbe's Rebbe, said, you know, it's the school's job, they're entitled to set the terms, and you have to tell them. While this conversation was taking place, and I should have said one thing at the start of the story. This is not a feel-good story where you're going to see the hand of God intervene. You're not going to see the Yad Hashem and Hashgacha Pratis here. While this is going on, while these shilas are being asked and discussed, he gets a voicemail message from the school offering him the job. And then the Rebbe's Rebbe tells him, you have to tell them. He calls up the school and says, I have to tell you that I'm not committed to you beyond a year. I might be going to graduate school afterwards. Of course, he doesn't know that he's going to get in then either. And the school, as is their right, withdraws the offer. I draw inspiration from this. I don't know if I stood in this student's shoes whether I would pass the same test. Just put yourself in that situation. You have a wife to support. It's easy to look at things as gray and fuzzy. You know, the school's not offering beyond a year. Very easy to be moraheter. Most people I know wouldn't even ask the shaila for Gnevas Das. I don't know if I would withstand this nisay. That's something to draw inspiration from. And when I look at that, despite all the shenanigans that we read in the newspapers, it gives me some sense of hope. This evening, I have chosen not to focus on very specific transgressions and problems in the community, but I've spoken in general halachic and ethical terms. I've done this for three reasons. Number one, unfortunately, as we say, to borrow a phrase that that we use in Hataras Nedarim, Ki rabim heim vi efshar lefartam. There are too many to enumerate. Secondly, in the spirit of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's dilemma in the Gemara Baba Basra, Daf Pei Tes Amud Beis, of whether or not he should publicize the details of crook schemes to alert people, or whether he'd be teaching more people more schemes, he said, Oy liim omar, oy liim lo omar. Woe to me if I do announce them, woe to me if I don't. I've chosen the path of lo omar. And finally, to do so might allow some of us who happen not to be guilty of specific transgressions that I might list to point the finger at other people. And here again, I would caution that some people in our community, the modern Orthodox community, tend to think of Sheker and Emes as problems of a different segment of the Frum community. And I believe that these are fundamentally problems of our community as well. I don't know if it's to the same degree, but I know it exists on a serious level. And our job is to identify our own problems, not the problems of others. Each one of us, I think, needs to engage in personal introspection in our personal, professional, and religious lives to identify any potential deficiencies in this area. The Gemara in Yoma in Sanhedrin observes that Chosamo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu Emes, God's seal is Emes, is truth. In effect, this is a reading of the Pasuk in this week's Parsha, Hatsur Tamim Paolo Kichod Rachav Mishpat El Emunah V'Yein Avel Tzadik B'Yashar Hu. God is Emunah, He is trustworthy. His word is His word. Hahu Amar V'Lo Ya'aseh V'Diber V'Lo Yikimena. There is a fascinating Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah, which speaks about how at the time of creation, the various midos appeared in front of God to argue whether or not man should be created. And one of the midos that argued against man's creation was the midas ha-emes. Emes said before God, Al yibaru, man should not be created. Shekulo shtarim, he is full of lies. What did God do? Ma'asa kadosh baruch hu, natal emes v'hishlicha la'eretz. He cast it down upon earth. The angels ask God, what are you doing with your holy seal? You're throwing it down to the ground. God responds, Tale emes min ha'aretz. Truth has to sprout from the ground. It is our obligation as people to bring emes into the world. To have emes in the higher and the celestial realms means nothing. We who face the challenges are commanded to make the world a truthful world. The Gemara in Shabbos makes a fascinating alphabetical observation with regards to the word Sheker and Emes. If you look at the word Sheker, the three letters, Shin, Kuf, and Resh, they're all right next to each other in the alphabet. They're consecutive. Why? Because Sheker is very easy to find. If you look at Emes, however, they are spread out almost as far as you can get. Aleph is the first letter, Taf is the last letter, and Mem is pretty close to the middle. Because Emes is difficult to find. On the other hand, the Gemara points out that ultimately Sheker does not stand, because if you look at the shapes of those three letters, and the shin is like the shin on the tefillin, not the shin that you see printed, they all stand on a point. And what happens if you leave the letters alone is they fall over. But Emes has three letters that have a wide base, and ultimately truth stands. Our challenge as Jews and as human beings is to bring Emes into the world, to serve as models for other Jews and other human beings. To fail to do so is to question our very existence as Jews, and as the Medrash tells us, as human beings. As we approach Yom Kippur, many of us, Ashkenazim certainly, will recite the Piyur of Nisane Tokef. Unisane Tokef Kiddushas Hayom Kihuno Rava Oyom Uvosi Nasei Malkusecha V'yikon Bachesed Kisecha V'seishev Alav Be'emes. God sits on His throne with truth. If the king and the judge who sits on the throne of judgment sits be'emes and signs his name with emes, we dare not appear in front of him without the soul-searching of our own and a commitment to truthfulness. May this year, Tavshin Ayin, be a year of renewed commitment to emes, to ethics, to scrupulousness in all inyanim of choshen mishpat, and may Yom HaKippurim Haba Aleinu L'tova produce a Gemar HaSima Tova for all of us, and for all of Klal Yisrael, and all of God's creation.